Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
An increasing knowledge in what it takes for food to get to our plates has spurred movements towards transparency and change in what we eat. Around the world, consumers are increasingly making purchasing decisions based on values related to environmental, social, and economic well-being. One of the largest attempts to achieve transparency and improve worker welfare is the Fair Trade Movement, a shift towards trading partnerships that offer better trading and working conditions for and increased rights of marginalized producers and workers who might not otherwise earn a living wage. Equal Exchange is the leading fair trade brand of food and beverages in the U.S., selling 100% certified fair trade coffee, cocoa, chocolate, sugar, bananas, and more. We're lucky to have Rodney North, Equal Exchange's answer man, in the studio today to speak to us about the growth of fair trade and Equal Exchange's unique role in the market. I'm Mariana Kotlier, and this is a special session of Heritage Radio. Rodney, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, and you've brought us some amazing treats. So we have some chocolate, some olive oil from the West Bank, and a geo bar that's produced with ingredients from all over the world. That's really amazing. Can you talk about this olive oil a little bit? I'm extremely curious.
Sure. So a thread that runs through our work at Equal Exchange is trying to work with farmers for whom the market isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this case, sometimes it's conventional market forces, you know, large importers and exporters are using their market power over small farmers. In this case, it's a different set of hurdles. And the small-scale olive growers in the West Bank, as you know, they're caught up in a big, you know, geopolitical struggle.
Right.
And they face a whole host of logistical, physical, political, as well as commercial obstacles just to do what they've been doing for 1,000 years,
mm-hmm.
you know, growing olives and making olive oil and then trying to sell that. And so it's now been about 2 years that we've been working with these farmers on the West Bank to bring in this fair trade organic olive oil and really help create a market for them where they hadn't had any.
Right.
And so far, so good. You know, thanks to the fact that we've been around now 27 years mm-hmm. and we sell to all 50 states, we even export a little. A lot of people know us and they know what we stand for.
Right.
Then maybe they know the coffee. And then we can kind of build off of that and introduce them to new things like the bananas or, in this case, the olive oil.
That's great. So you mentioned that you've been around for 27 years, and that's quite a long and impressive history. I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit about the sort of the history of Equal Exchange's work in fair trade specifically, and where the idea of fair trade came from, and how it's shifted throughout the years.
Yeah, so really, a lot of people point to the work of two faith-based groups here in the United States and after World War II. And they were working with artisans and handicrafts.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a group now known as 10,000 Villages that came out of the Mennonite community. And also another group called SERVE, that's an acronym, and they're affiliated with the Church of the Brethren. And they were a pioneer, really ahead of their time, of thinking about, let's use commerce as a way to aid people in need,
mm.
whether it was the refugees of Europe after the devastation of the war, or just struggling artisans in the Caribbean and Puerto Rico. So they did this for a long time, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and so on. And also, some folks were doing that in Europe itself.
Mm-hmm.
And what Equal Exchange did was to... And by the way, there is a sort of co-evolution. Even as Equal Exchange was getting started in the mid-80s, others were doing some stuff like this in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And what Equal Exchange did was apply some of those ideas to foods. And Now, while we started with a whole variety of different products, really it was coffee was our most important one, specifically a coffee from Nicaragua. Mm-hmm. And this was during the Reagan-Bush Sr. embargo of Nicaragua. And Nicaragua, famous coffee-growing country, mm-hmm. that's its number one export, its number one market was the United States. And so with the embargo, which the embargo was one of the repercussions of the Sandinista overthrow of the Somoza dictatorship. And so that's kind of the lifeblood of the Nicaraguan economy was being choked off. And these small farmers, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, are caught in a crossfire of this big geopolitical struggle. And so Equal Exchange found, and this is sort of... I think a good indicator of how we got to where we are now, where, you know, we'd run into what seems like a dead end, and we'd keep going, keep moving, and try to find a way up and around or under. And in this case, there was a clause in the embargo where if a Nicaraguan product went to some other country, like the Netherlands, mm-hmm. was transformed, processed, packaged, it then became a Dutch product, or Canadian, okay. As the case may be. So... we were exporting, or the Nicaraguan suppliers growing this, the small farmer-grown coffee, would export the coffee to the Netherlands, where it'd be roasted and packaged.
Wow.
Then it becomes Dutch, and then we could bring it in. And that we called that Cafe Nica, the forbidden coffee.
Amazing.
And it led to a big struggle with the State Department and the Commerce Department about, you know, could we bring this in? And that was kind of like the coming out party for Equal Exchange. but it worked. Later, the embargo dropped, and we didn't have to go through this roundabout way.
Right.
We could import directly. But that was how we sort of, you know, that was our start.
So, I mean, that sounds like an incredible challenge to confront, particularly you're getting involved in, you know, in these very stressful and... you know, complex geopolitical situations. What made Equal Exchange decide to get in there and kind of face those challenges head on? I can imagine, you know, that was probably the least sure. easy way of doing business in any kind of exports.
Yeah, you can imagine as a small business, there's three guys. You have a single product and it's embargoed. it's all tied up in warehouses, you know, in the port of Boston. Not an auspicious beginning.
Right.
Though they were able to turn that to their advantage. So the three founders of Equal Exchange were Jonathan Rosenthal, Michael Rosine, and Rink Dickinson. And they were working in the natural foods movement, specifically the cooperative movement. There was, back in the 70s and 80s, something we don't have anymore, which were cooperative distributors, mm-hmm. where lots of small businesses and buying clubs... grocery stores, natural food restaurants, together they would own a distributor who would source and distribute natural foods, organic foods, locally grown produce products. So while these three were like in on the ground floor of a food revolution, they could see how it was benefiting people in New England. The name of the business was Northeast. They worked in Boston. And they could see benefits for New England farmers and also the New England businesses, consumers, who were trying to be part of this alternative market. Mm-hmm. But also, they were bringing in stuff from all over the world, you know, rice and coconut and coffee. And you know, they were politically aware. Some of them had traveled. They'd been to Sri Lanka, where there was a big geopolitical struggle, a civil war going on. So they knew, it's like, okay, well, what about the coffee that we're handling? You know, what's the story behind that? And, you know, it doesn't take much scratching when you're looking at something like coffee or bananas, another tropical product with a really notorious history, to find out, okay, I'm not so comfortable where that coffee is coming from and how it gets to us.
Right.
Can we do better? And so they got together every week for a number of years, even while they're working, you know, the day job at Northeast distributing the food. And some of them were buyers, and some of them were selling for Northeast. And they tried to encourage Northeast as a business to take on this alternative model, where they would adopt that fair trade idea that I was talking about with crafts, but apply it for, in this case, coffee, and hopefully other products, other tropical products. And Northeast, they didn't bite. And maybe that was, you know, sometimes no is really the right answer in the long term. And that seemed to have worked out
well.
It
forces you to adapt.
Yeah, yeah. So they would have to go off on their own and create their own business.
Wow. So does Equal Exchange have a specific definition for what fair trade is?
We do, though it tends to be really wordy.
Okay.
I'd say that we're trying to use trade as a tool to transform what's wrong with the market for small-scale farmers. Mm-hmm. And so it's not, for example, it's not just about trying to address poverty or to, it's not just about the price paid for a bag of coffee or a delivery of bananas, but to voluntarily change the terms of trade to make the market work finally for the benefit of the farmers and farmers' community, mm-hmm. so that they get more of the value that they've been creating. They've been creating it for centuries, but they're just never getting the value out of it.
Right.
And that they... I remember I had the conversation with one of the co-founders, Rink, back in 97. I just started at Equal Exchange. And basically, I was kind of asking, what are we here to do? And one way that he answered it was, well, if Equal Exchange disappears, folds, but the farmer cooperatives that we work with, if they are better off than they had been, mm-hmm. they have more professionalism, more resources, more options in the market, more, basically, they're not just sort of a passive part of the market that gets sort of battered around by market forces and by bigger players. If they're better off and stronger, we will have achieved something. So we're just constantly pushing that, first with coffee and then with every opportunity. We're moving into new sectors like tea, chocolate, olive oil, and trying to use the magic of the market but turn it around so that it's actually empowering not just small farmers, but small farmers that are working together with their neighbors.
Wow. So my understanding of fair trade is that it's based on the idea that consumers are willing to pay a price premium to know that the products they buy have been produced in a conscientious way, you know, along kind of the parameters that you were mentioning before. But back when Equal Exchange started, I gather this was a pretty new idea, and you know, consumers didn't, first of all, there wasn't a standard term that they could look at. Fair trade wasn't the kind of trademark phrase that it is now. So how did you reach those people? And most importantly, how did you know that they would be willing to pay that price premium for your products?
There's so much there.
Yeah.
For one thing, we didn't know that people would. And by the way, I've been there 17 of the 27 years, so I wasn't there at the beginning, but I've heard a lot about it.
Yeah.
Worked alongside the founders. And so, no, it was like so many people who were trying something really important, it's an unproven concept. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you probably don't interview the ones for whom it didn't work.
Right.
So there's some of it is faith. There's faith that you're not alone in feeling this way, and that if other people knew what you knew, that they might feel the same. And we see that across the food industry, around organic farming, or it's buying local, or simpler ingredients, you know, non-processed foods, mm-hmm. that you give people information, some percentage of them will get it. Mm-hmm. So there's that. Also, with fair trade, you're right, there wasn't this now well-known concept. And in fact, back then it was called alternative trade. The idea was to create markets that were alternative to conventional business. Uh-huh. Which, when you fast forward to today, and you have Fortune 500 brands handling fair trade products, for some of us, it can be a bit of a head scratcher. It's a kind of progress.
Right.
But we keep trying to remind people that we weren't just trying to take the hard edge off the marketplace, but to create an alternative path to market from the farmers to the eaters. So Yeah, back in 86 when we started, no, there wasn't the term. There were no certifiers. They wouldn't come along until more than 10 years later. Mm-hmm. There was no market. We'd have to build the market. And again, this is analogous to what many food pioneers run into.
That's, yeah, I think that that really, that's a lesson that a lot of the kind of new producers that are trying to produce according to, you know, sustainable and biodynamic processes can learn from when they're trying to reach their markets. So we're speaking to Rodney North, the answer man from Equal Exchange. This is a special session of Heritage Radio. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back in a few minutes.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery. Thank you for listening to the show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. For more information, visit cane5.com.
We're here with Rodney North, the answer man from Equal Exchange, on this special session of Heritage Radio. I'm Mariana Cotlier, and we are chatting all about fair trade. So Rodney, you were just mentioning to me that one of the challenges you faced when you were starting Equal Exchange was that people thought there wasn't a problem.
Yeah, so the one of the things that so the founders are trying to promote this novel approach to coffee trade, and some of the things they heard were, A, there's not a problem. You know, the situation's fine. It doesn't need fixing. Even, you know, now we knew there was rampant poverty and exploitation there where coffee was grown. They're saying, no, this is just how the market works. Don't mess with it. So there's not a problem.
Right.
Your idea of fair trade, you know, paying more, long-term relationships, buying directly from cooperatives, it won't work. So there's not a problem. Your idea won't work anyway, and nobody wants what you're selling. People don't care about this stuff.
Yeah.
And so we had to argue back, no, there is a problem. The status quo is not acceptable.
Right.
Now, does that sound familiar? You know, we run into that a lot in the food industry.
Absolutely.
With GMOs or what have you.
Yeah.
Yes, there's a problem. Well, just wait. We'll, you know, give us a chance. We'll try to make this work. And that's a big part of what we're always trying to do as we move into new categories is prove, yes, you can get olive oil out of the West Bank. Yes, you can trade bananas right. differently. And then, if people knew where their food came from, they would care.
They would
and
care.
Now we know later, yes, in fact, they did care.
Yeah, and people are clearly willing to, you know, they're willing to pay more for those products and they want them. You kind of mentioned the fact that, you know, people thought there wasn't a problem. And, you know, I wanted to bring up something that I have always found interesting, that, you know, that I learned in my undergraduate economics, which is that you know, some economists, including Nobel Prize winner Paul Krugman, have claimed that fair trade actually exacerbates economic disparity by paying some workers more while other workers can't enter into the market. Do you have a perspective on that or any thoughts on, you know, how do you respond to those types of criticisms?
First, I roll my eyes. So, like, I've done debates with, like, the chair of the econ department at Suffolk University, and that was a very indicative debate, because what we run into time and again is the people who are making these specific kind of free market critiques of mm-hmm. fair trade actually don't know how it works.
Okay.
They're mistaking cooperatives with cartels. They mistake a voluntary process, fair trade, with state-imposed price regulation. And the short version is just that time and again, the critiques are based on misconceptions of fair trade. Mm-hmm. It's a voluntary process. It's predicated upon more information. You know where the food is coming from, how it was traded, who grew it, who brought it in, and so on. And people, be it us, the importer, roaster, or your store down the street, or you, the shopper, everybody is making voluntarily free decisions. It's like, yes, when I know XYZ about this product, it was fair trade, it's not a GMO, etc., mm-hmm. I will pay more for that.
Right.
So it's actually completely consistent with the best part of free markets.
Yeah, that's a great response. So in recent years, there have been some shakeups in the fair trade certification organizations and the organizations that kind of govern the standards of fair trade. How has that impacted, well, first of all, what's going on? And second of all, how has that impacted Equal Exchange specifically?
So for the average eater who's paying some attention, one of the things that has happened is there's now a proliferation of fair trade certifiers and seals that you might see.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time, there was what we call the bucket boy, a black and white logo that you find on fair trade foods. And more recently, you'll see an orange one, orange and white, which says fair for life. There is now one that's used in the rest of the world. Now, we're using it, for example, in our bananas, mm-hmm. and it's a blue, black, and green kind of swirly logo. There's also a very new one, and we're going to be using it more on our coffees, called the SPP, or Símbolo de Productores Pequeños, or the small producer symbol,
mm-hmm.
Which, very excitingly, is the first certification overseen by small farmer organizations themselves. The others are all northern run, out of Europe or, mm-hmm. or Oakland. And so now there's a bunch of these.
Wow.
And I'd say what's most relevant in this context is that it's like what we've seen in so many sort of reform efforts. You get an idea. The idea comes first, and you have the pioneers who implement it. They prove the concept. And then later, it gets codified. People come along. They make up rules specifying what is organic, or in this case, what is fair trade. So then you get your certifiers. And then there get to be debates about, well, what gets to use these magic words like fair trade.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, these initiatives usually start with small mission-driven organizations. They create the market, they prove the idea, they create the supply chains, and then later, more conventional-minded businesses say, oh, I see an opportunity. Let's get some of that fair trade stuff and add it to our product line.
Right.
Now, admittedly, you know, the world's a complicated place, and we know some really mission-driven individuals in big companies who want to do the right thing for the right reasons. But also, you have more prosaic reasons to like to add some fair trade stuff into your product line.
Sure.
And part of the struggle is, okay, how low can we push the standards and still get this sort of magical logo that helps to sell our products? So there gets to be a debate, and that's what we've had in the fair trade movement. We personally, you know, having been there from the beginning, feel that the more dominant certifier here, called Fairtrade USA, that they're going too far to accommodate the big players,
mm-hmm.
and are accommodating that desire for, okay, let's just do as little as we have to conventional supply chains and still get this logo. So, for example, they're opening up eligibility to plantations.
Mm-hmm.
And for those people who have studied Latin American history or a lot of the history of commodities, plantations are kind of one of the emblematic of what's wrong with these rural economies and the domination of many people by a few. And so we don't want to just, like I said, take the hard edge off of the status quo. We want to really give the small farmers a chance to finally compete in the world marketplace. So we and others, especially this new system called SPP,
mm-hmm.
it looks kind of like an Aztec or a Mayan glyph or
okay.
a hieroglyph. That we think that fair trade should remain as it got started, which is as a small farmer founded, small farmer focused movement. And as it is, like just take coffee, the most popular fair trade item. Cooperatives certified in the fair trade system already grow three times more coffee than what they can sell as fair trade. So that's about, when you do the math, basically they have another 500 million pounds of coffee they're growing annually that they have to sell into conventional markets. Mm-hmm. So there's already a surplus of fair trade product. If you now begin to certify the big plantations who have always had all the advantages in the marketplace, mm-hmm. These co-ops are going to they're going to see their sales go down,
right,
as plantations pick up more of the fair trade market share. So we and others are trying to push back. The Fair World Project puts out a great magazine called Better World Magazine, and between their magazine and other efforts, they and others are helping to sort of educate people about this schism within the fair trade movement and encourage retailers, food companies, because mm-hmm. food companies now have this choice. They can pick different certifications, and we're encouraging folks basically not to pick Fairtrade USA so long as they adhere to this more sort of market-friendly approach. And yeah, so we're encouraging
this folks is very to get, complicated.
Yeah, we want folks to, well, it really goes back to so many of the issues we find throughout the food world where there's a lot of education required.
Absolutely. And this kind of plays into, you know, labeling, not only in the GMO space, but in many different categories in food, where most consumers really do want something on the package just to explain whether something is grass-fed, organic,
humane,
or fair trade. And now it seems like there are many different options even within the fair trade category that mean dramatically different things. So what do you recommend to, you know, to consumers that really do care, that want their products to adhere to certain standards? How do you recommend that they, you know, that they shop and inform themselves about these standards?
One is, you know, we talk about get to know your farmer. Well, get to know your food company, whether it's bananas or coffee or what have you. The ones who, and we're by from we are hardly the only food company to be adhering to these standards. Mm-hmm. There's some great small coffee roasters. There's also a chocolate company, Divine, that sells fair trade chocolate, that is definitely doing the right thing. So get to know these companies better. Like Divine, for example, is actually owned by small farmers in West Africa. You know, check out this magazine, A Better World magazine, which is actually in many food stores, mm-hmm. and food co-ops. Check out the Fair World Project. We provide actually longer answers than I can give you today,
sure,
on our website.
Yeah.
So if people go to www.equalexchange.coop, they can type in a small farmer campaign or authentic fair trade campaign, and it'll take you right to our resource page. Mm-hmm. We're encouraging people to write to some of the more the larger volume fair trade importers like Green Mountain Coffee and Starbucks, and encouraging them to do the right thing, to ask their retailers, you know, to stock fair trade products that are still focused on the small farmer, and obviously to make informed choices, you know, as they go up and down the aisles.
So interesting. Now, I'm curious, we've spoken a little bit about how you have proven that there really is consumer demand for these more conscientiously produced products. But, you know, over the last 10 years, we've also seen a shift in these conscientious consumers who are probably your market, who really want to shop close to home, in the local foods movement. Most of your food, you know, comes from all over the world. It travels many, many miles to get to our plates. So how have you seen consumers respond to that? Or have you seen a change in their behavior in that they still want to support farmers worldwide, but they care more about, you know, the farmer that's 100 miles away versus 100,000?
Yeah, really, for probably been it's a couple hundred years now, we've had a global diet. With every year, more and more of our diet, just, you know, if you were to count the calories, are coming from abroad. If right. nothing else, as we become more affluent, we can afford quote luxuries like chocolate and coffee, olive oil. And so we've, you know, you can only tackle so many things, and at Equal Exchange we try to tackle a whole lot, you know, not just the fair trade or organic foods, but also creating a worker cooperative. But we're trying to focus on internationally sourced products, because mm-hmm. for the foreseeable future, we're going to, you know, drink coffee and tea. We're going to eat bananas. So what can we do to reform those markets? And one way we talk about it is that you got your farmer's market for your local products. Mm-hmm. And then for everything else, we're trying to be your international farmer's market.
Right.
To provide you these things, coffee, tea, cocoa, bananas, along the same values as what you're getting when you patronize your local farmers market or CSA.
Sure. There aren't coffee or coffee trees growing in Brooklyn anytime soon.
No.
Unfortunately. No. I'm sure somebody will try. So in addition to the fair trade standards that increase wages and improve working conditions, are there other ways that you invest in the international communities in which you work?
We actually do. We don't talk about it much because it's really sort of icing on the cake. It's not the cake itself. But we donate 10% of our profits every year to different nonprofits or producer farmer organizations that are working in or on behalf of fair trade or the cooperative movement.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have time for it now, but we think the cooperative business model is key to reforming a big chunks of the marketplace. Mm-hmm. So there's that. And also we do a lot of advocacy. And another thing we don't have time to talk about now is how, despite being a secular organization, you know, for-profit, employee-owned business, we have 12 fantastic partnerships with faith-based groups across the spectrum. American Jewish World Service, Catholic Relief Services, Lutheran World Relief, and so on. United Methodist Committee on Relief right here in New York. And through them, we're trying to help educate their communities, Jewish, Catholic, Presbyterian, Mennonite, mm-hmm. About these issues and about these opportunities. Because really, every time, you know, you reach for olive oil or tea, that's an opportunity to act.
Yeah.
And you can kind of perpetuate the status quo or, you know, nudge the market a little bit into this other, more progressive, we think, equitable, sustainable method. We're also working with schools. You know, it's not much thought of, but the fundraising market, like for high schools and elementary schools, is a multi-billion-dollar market,
mm-hmm.
which, unlike the food industry, is largely unreformed.
Right.
So we've created a fundraising program for elementary and high schools featuring these organic fair trade products. So instead of hustling, you know, Hershey candy bars or magazine subscriptions, kids can be selling these products, but also learning about, oh, these things come from somewhere. And we created a curriculum that goes along with, that can be used with the fundraiser, so that even as kids are raising money for the band or the debate club or whatever, they're learning about, oh, so cocoa comes from these weird, funky kind of Star Trek type of trees in the Dominican Republic, and there are these farming issues, and like, well, why does it grow there and not in Brooklyn?
Right.
And what are the economics behind trade? So really, and this is part of our MO over the years, is kind of like just trying lots of stuff and trying to reach not just new farmer groups, but also new people. So whether it's at the kids in school or faith-based groups, really anybody who will give us the time of day,
mm-hmm.
Talk to them about this stuff, and then create some sort of market opportunity where they can participate in something that we think is healthier, you know, in the broad sense of healthy.
Sure. Now, when you do reach out to new farmer groups, what's the process like for, you know, entering into a new community and introducing this fair trade trading relationship?
It's much more complicated than the normal way of doing business. and that is, I think that's going to be true for all kinds of people who are trying to do something really exciting and ambitious. So we need everything that a conventional business would need, reliable quality, you know, sufficient quantities, reliable quantities, you know, like with the banana trade, you have to be moving a certain amount all the time.
Right.
And so you're asking all of those questions, but also who's doing the most exciting work in their communities? Because we don't want to just, you know, buy their almonds or buy their bananas. We want to know that we can foster change in, you know, rural Ecuador, mm-hmm. or, you know, rural Uganda.
And is there a quality component as well that you evaluate?
It can be. Yes, there is.
It has to taste really good.
Yes, yes. Because, and the farmers know that. And we actually work extensively with our farmer partners on that. And they get it. They're no slouches. They know that if they don't deliver top quality to us, we won't be around very long. And they're going to lose their best customer.
Right.
And we know that. And also, you remember, we're an employee-owned business. We're roasting the coffee. We're selling it. We're standing behind it. And we want to be able to be proud of what we're delivering. But all of us, the farmers and us and our partners, know that if we don't deliver quality, none of the rest is going to happen. So you have to start from there, and then you have to make it affordable. You have to have a good product selection. You have to have great customer service. You got to go out in radio stations and do interviews. You got to tell the story.
Yeah.
You got to do all these things if you're going to make that change
in
those farmer communities.
Yeah. We just have time for one more. I'm curious, you know, in addition to this, the great work that you're doing in international development, you also work in communities around the country, or Equal Exchange has offices around the country. Do you do work at the local level here in the United States as well?
I'd say that the most important local work we do is, as we say, sort of being the farmer's friend.
Right.
The farmers are doing the farming, and what we need to do is sort of take the coffee or the tea the last mile to the tea drinker and the coffee drinker, and tell them the farmer's story, help either bring the farmers here so they can tell their own story, uh-huh. or we can help to tell it for them. Find allies like Catholic Relief Services or, you know, the food co-ops like mm-hmm. Park Slope Co-op.
Sure.
Find those and other retailers, cafe owners who care about this stuff and want to tell their customers and their employees about it. So you could say, you know, moving the product year after year, moving more of it, and being an advocate is our local work.
That's great. Rodney, where can we find some of your delicious chocolate and coffee for those online shoppers who don't have an Equal Exchange nearby?
Well, you can check out our totally overhauled website, www.equalexchange.coop. There's a link to our store. The online store is going to be totally overhauled in about 10 days. So please come back again and check that out when that happens. But we're in food cooperatives nationwide, a lot of family grocery chains, independent food stores. Our chocolate are found in almost all of the Whole Foods. We're in schools and, you know, synagogues and churches, really anywhere that people eat chocolate and drink coffee and eat bananas.
Great. Well, on that note, I think I'm going to have some of this chocolate. Rodney North from Equal Exchange, thank you so much for joining us. I'm Mariana Cotlier, and this has been a special session of Heritage Radio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.